You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2018 Tour de France in association with Rafa. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport. Today we're in Laren.
Hopefully we can ride well as a team as we have done all race and keep racing the same way, then hopefully we'll be okay.
I think it's completely fanciful to think that Geraint Thomas is a potential Tour de France winner. I just don't see it happening. Well, we were played in there by Geraint Thomas talking at the start of today's stage in Lourdes, and then there was a clip from a podcast that was released last week after the La Rosière stage where Geraint Thomas won the stage and took the yellow jersey. And I was, well... You heard what I thought.
Nostradamus Moore there, getting it hopelessly wrong.
Hopelessly wrong. But I'm surprised. I mean, here we are with one serious stage to go of the Tour de France, and barring some catastrophe, as they say, Geraint Thomas is going to win the Tour de France.
It very much looks like that now, doesn't it? A healthy old lead over Tom Dumoulin, 2 minutes and 5 seconds. Well, he extended it by 6 seconds today, and we thought that already would be enough for the time trial. Primoz Roglic has kind of loomed into contention, but really, I think the limit of his chances are second place. He's not going to win it, is he?
Well, we've got Francois Thomas with us as well.
Hi there.
A challenging day. We're in the car heading back to our... Well, Le Viscos, we spoke about that last night, and it lived up to its billing. Wonderful evening.
Oh, it was. I was really, really hungry. And
I'll let you, Lionel.
We'd had a very light day. Breakfast was extremely disappointing, just a sort of small piece of baguette and a croissant. Lunch was another baguette with some chicken and salad in it. I was absolutely ravenous by 9:30, 9:45 when we finally ate. Well, what do we have? We had some sliced saucisson sec. We had a beautiful piece of mild foie gras with a cooked piece of foie gras on toast and a sort of blackcurrant jam, I think it was. Then we had some sort of pastry noodles with some crab and lemon. And then we had the Bigorre pork, the local Pyrenean pork, cooked rare with some wild mushrooms, local mushrooms. And then I had a chocolate dessert, which was a disc of tempered chocolate and a chocolate biscuit and a chocolate mousse. I mean, an absolutely phenomenal meal. Thank you, Francois, for introducing us to Le Viscos.
Well, my favourite bit was when the chef got the waiter to turn around so that he could demonstrate from which part of the pig's body the meat came from.
Yeah, it's kind of... it's a part of the back, yeah, because it's called presse de porc, which was funny because there was a table of journalists, so it was all the press, and this part of the pork is called presse de porc, which in English, well, in French, or translated into English, would mean I don't know, scum press or something. But there you are. We were a bunch of press guys eating press. It was interesting. No, really great meal as usual. I mean, I told you it's part of the. I think you can't really say you're a seasoned, tour pro follower, suiveur, as we say, if you haven't gone to the Sudoviscos once.
Well, we're heading back there. Hopefully, we'll get something a little bit lighter maybe this evening, see what's on the menu. But,
there was some cycling today, wasn't there? Shall we hear the tale of the attack?
Well, Richard, it was stage 19, 200.5 kilometres from Lourdes to Laren, the final Pyrenean mountain stage. There were two small climbs at the start, and then the Col d'Aspin, the Col du Tourmalet, the Col des Bordères, which then ran into the Soulor, and finally the Aubisque before a 20-kilometre descent into the finish. Lots of very strong riders got up the road before the Tourmalet. Bob Jungels, Warren Barguil, Bauke Mollema, Tanel Kanga, Mikel Nieve, Gorka Izagirre, Adam Yates, Julian Alaphilippe, Andre Amador, Daniele Benatti, Tom Jelte Slagda and Roman Hardy. I mean, that's a who's who, really, of the riders who've been on the attack in the Alps and Pyrenees, plus Benatti and Hardy. The real action kind of kicked off around about halfway through the stage on the Tourmalet. There was all sorts going on. Katusha was setting up for Ilnur Zakarin. Mikel Landa for Movistar went away. Roman Bardet tried an attack. And then Fuglsang and Rafał Majka went away. Sky kept their cool. And at they just let the gaps open but kept it under control. Landa and Mika dropped Bardet and Zakarin through La Mangie, and then really the final part of the stage that really mattered was from about 50 kilometres to go, when Robert Hessink of Lotto NL Jumbo began riding on the front of the Geraint Thomas GC favourites group. That was to set up Primoz Roglic and Steven Kruiswijk for a number of attacks. They each attacked multiple times, as did Tom Dumoulin. Chris Froome looked fallible at times. Geraint Thomas was rock solid, and as it went over the top of the Orbisque, it was Roglic who was clear on his own, dropped Mika, and then descended like a demon down into the finish. So Roglic won the stage. Geraint Thomas then won the sprint for second to take a 6-second time bonus. Romain Bardet was third, ahead of Dan Martin, Rafał Majka and Tom Dumoulin. So overall, Geraint Thomas now leads by 2 minutes and 5 seconds ahead of Dumoulin, with Roglic, the stage winner, up to third. So it's a real three-way battle for the two places on the podium tomorrow. So it'll be between Dumoulin, Roglic and Froome, who slipped from third to fourth. The big loser of the day was Nairo Quintana, who fell from fifth to ninth. Jakob Fuglsang has also slipped out of the top 10. Peter Sagan had a torrid day, but he managed to make the time cut. He's suffering from the injuries sustained in his crash a couple of days ago that made the time cut quite comfortably, and now should win a record equaling sixth green jersey in Paris. Julian Alaphilippe, who was first to the top of the Aspen and Tourmalet, has wrapped up the King of the Mountains jersey in impressive style. And Pierre Latour, although he conceded a chunk of time to Egan Bernal today, looks like he will win the white jersey.
A community around the world, stories and films with the most compelling characters, the world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Hi, I'm Laura from Rafa. At Rafa, we believe that cycling transforms lives and that cycling is the answer to many of our daily problems and challenges. I rode the Women's 100 with Rafa, and it introduced me to a whole new group of friends, women like me, who love to live their life in Lycra. At Rafa, we have 23 clubhouses around the world with 300 rides a week and thousands of people. So wherever you are, we invite you to ride with us. You can go to rafa.cc to find a ride near you.
Thank you for that comprehensive summary of the stage, Lionel, and a big thank you to Rafa, our headline sponsor. We went and found Julian Alaphilippe, the King of the Mountains, who was again up the road today, as we heard, and presented him with an even more coveted garment, the Rafa Pedlar de Charme t-shirt. He was delighted to get it. And we also had a jury's choice Pedlar de Charme, who our kind of pick for the 3 weeks, and I think it was Francois who suggested the gentleman in question.
Yeah, I've always been, in the last three or four seasons, a great admirer of Greg Van Avermaet, because this guy can do everything, you know, win one day classics, be Olympic champion, which is not so bad, win Tour de France stages, you know, all the yellow jersey for a couple of days this year. He's always available to the press, to the public, to fans, to sign. He's always smiling, speaks four or five languages. I mean, this guy is just, you know, a great, great rider, a great man. And look at this Tour de France. I mean, we think of him as the specialist of a classic specialist, and he's now, you know, 28th overall, with the end of the Tour looming. I mean, he's had a great performance, a great show of strength in the for a non-climber in the big climbs in the Alps and the Pyrenees. He was never so far away from the leading group. And I think that this man is just extraordinary. And given is the way he represents cycling, but as a man, the way he behaves to the fans, the way he behaves, the way he his elegance on the bike and his versatility, I think he really deserves a honorary Pedlar de Charme t-shirt.
Well, he is always pretty charming, and as you say, Francois was always available. And so I went and found him this morning and gave him the Pedlar de Charme t-shirt. Here's what he had to say.
Greg, you've had a tremendous tour, but you've kept on, and you're on the fringes of the top 20 overall. What's led to this new way of riding for you?
Well, I think this overall came by himself. You know, I tried to go in the break as much as possible, and yeah, I gained like 45 minutes on the GC guy, so it was getting kind of easier to get in. But yeah, pretty happy with my tour, especially with the days in yellow, where we're always super special for me. And yeah, Roubaix stage in yellow stands out a bit for me. Yeah, pretty happy with how the tour went.
Have you enjoyed the challenge of, you know, hanging on in the mountains and seeing what you can do there?
Not really. No, I don't like to suffer in the mountains. I have two good days in the mountains, but all the rest I'm suffering, and yeah, I'm never gonna be a climber, and it was not really nice. But yeah, it's cool to end up close to GC guys, but it's never been a goal actually.
Finally, you can reflect on a good Tour de France, so, and topped off with the Pedler de Charme. Is that more mean more to you than the yellow jersey?
Yeah, getting close. The yellow jersey is a little bit ahead still, but the Pedler de Charme shirt is also one of the highlights of the tour.
That was Greg Van Avermaet, our jury's choice Pedler de Charme for the Tour de France. He didn't have such a good day today, actually, but he's been hovering around the top 20. So, you know, in the absence of Richie Port, he's ridden his own race and ridden very well. I did mention Richie Port. It's just one of the things that I wonder in this Tour de France, where Geraint Thomas has emerged as the champion elect. Richie Port obviously crashed out, Vincenzo Nibali out, and I just find myself wondering whether, you know, had those two guys been in the race and had the clear run that Geraint Thomas has had, whether, you know, we might be looking at a different podium. We'll never know. But it's been a kind of strange tour in a way, and Geraint Thomas has been incredibly impressive. He's won two mountain stages, and even today at the end, you know, he looked good, he looked fresh, and he didn't look in trouble at all at any point. But it seems that all the bad luck he's had in the past, all the misfortune, has been compensated for here somehow.
That's the whole point. I mean, you mentioned Richie Porte and Vincenzo Nibali, but they crashed. Geraint Thomas didn't crash, and that's part of winning the Tour. That's part of winning the Grand Tour. You have we call it in French la chance du vainqueur, the luck of the winner. It is something that when you're in top shape, when you have the best team, when everything goes according into plan, when everything clicks into place, nothing can happen to you. You kind of fly, you know, throughout the Tour, and yes, you're just invincible. And that's the magic moment. You, like the Americans would say, he was in the zone. You know, Geraint Thomas has been, yeah, it's probably the most special moment in his career. And it happens from time to time when a rider or an athlete reaches this strange, stage when everything goes right. I mean, it's happened in the past when Vincenzo Nibali won the Tour in 2014. Well, they're exactly the same. You had the impression he could win anything. Nothing was hurting. No accident, no incident, no crash, no nothing. And I guess that's what happens when you win the Tour most of the time.
Let's talk about the stage, though, because it was an absorbing stage, as you've said, Lionel. And it really, you know, it was a long stage, very different to the one we had a couple of days ago. A really brutal brutal stage with a very, very difficult descent into the finish. A little bit like a couple of years ago into Morzine. On that occasion, you felt like the GC race was sort of neutralised, and it was bad weather, and they didn't take too many risks. Today, you know, you were watching that with your heart in your mouth, because at any moment, somebody's tour could have ended, and they were racing down there, properly racing. Roglic obviously was very impressive in the end and won the stage. The action began from 100 kilometres to go on the Col du Tourmalet, on the lower slopes of the Tourmalet, when it was actually Katusha Alpecin. The four men left at Katusha Alpecin went to the front, and before the Tourmalet they began driving it. We'll hear a little bit of insight into that later on, but people wondered what they were doing. We'll hear what they were doing later, but they set it up the attack for Zakarin. He went, Ilner Zakarin, and Mika Landa followed. Now, Mika Landa was more of a danger overall, but Sky didn't react at all. Castroviejo was on the front. They didn't up the pace at all, and the gap went out to 3 minutes to Landa, which at that point, you know, he wasn't that far down overall, and he's coming into the virtual podium at that point. And so you wonder when's the panic bell's going to start ringing. It was actually Robert Hessink of Lotto NL Jumbo who then took it up because of the threat, presumably, to to their riders, Roglic and Kruijswijk, and their overall positions. I mean, Hesink on his own brought the gap down from about 3 minutes to about a minute.
It was the best tactical move by Sky during the whole tour. I mean, let's make it clear. This was by far the best stage in this Tour de France. One of the best stages we've seen for a long time. We often complain at the great battle that does not happen, and sometimes the queen stages are, you know, a little bit disappointing. This time the big battle took place, and really the very very clever tactical move was made by Sky, because by forcing the gap to increase to 3 minutes, it put actually Roglic and Kruijswijk, I mean the two Lotto Jumbo leaders, positions in danger. So they actually forced Lotto Jumbo to work for them, which was absolutely, you know, genius in terms of tactics. I'm 100% convinced it was planned. They did it on purpose to force others to lead the way and to kind of, in a way, to trap them into assuming a role they were not ready to take upon their shoulders. And it was really, really well done.
It was. And I saw people reacting on social media while the race was unfolding and saying, well, why are Lotto and El Jumbo doing this? They're doing Sky's work for them. This happens so often in the Grand Tours. There were, you know, Sky and Lotto and El Jumbo had similar goals. They wanted to bring in Landa, and Sky knew they didn't have to do that work, whereas Lotto and El Jumbo did if they were going to. Well, it worked out perfectly for them as well, because they won the stage with Roglic, and they have Roglic in a very, very good position to finish on the podium. He may even finish second in the Tour if he time trials better than Dumoulin tomorrow. So, you know, it's kind of what they had, really no choice. That was absolutely what they were going to do to get out of the Tour the best possible results they could. And I think they played it really well as well today, because they got Roglic into the position to then accelerate away. I mean, it wasn't the first attempt to get away. It was one of a number of attempts to get away. And, I mean, he descended absolutely brilliantly. It really was sort of, if I'd been on the sofa, I would have been behind the sofa, sort of watching Doctor Who style, like we did as kids. Because it was, it was a nervy old descent. And it was very fortunate that it didn't rain. There was a forecast for a little bit of rain this afternoon, but it didn't materialise. One thing I felt very sympathetic for Roglic in the press conference, at first, I think two questions were whether or not he felt he had an unfair advantage chasing the motorbike, because Tom Dumoulin made some comments at the finish about the proximity of the motorbikes to Roglic. And this is something that, you know, we're very aware of, and sometimes the riders speak out. Jonathan Vaughters actually said to us when we had our event back in Annecy on the first rest day, he said the biggest outside influence in bike racing at the moment is the TV motorbikes.
But you must have the skills of someone like Roglic to follow the motorbikes in the descent. And sometimes you even go for, I mean, the way he descended, I mean, we know he was a ski jumper. So, I mean, ski jumper is a really reckless sport. I mean, you can't be afraid to do that. So obviously, he had, you know, because of his past as a ski jumper, Roglic has probably more guts than some other guys. But at that stage of the stage, for Team Sky, the everything was going according to plan. The Geraint Thomas had maintained his yellow jersey. That was the main goal. And what I liked in this stage as well, I said about roughly the same thing about the short stage, the 65 kilometer stage the other day. But today, once again, everybody played their role right, because Movistar, once again, we know what they're doing. They send Valverde up front, and then, you know, he kind of acts as a relay for either Landa or Quintana. The other day was Quintana, and it worked. This time it was Landa, who you know, Landa. We said that before, but the effects of it, the effects of his crash in Roubaix remain unknown, because what he did today, he was at the front for a lot of the race, showed that probably, had he not crashed, he would have been, well, maybe not a contender, but doing all right. So Movistar played well. Team Sky played to perfection. Lotto Jumbo did what he had to do and won the stage. Even Romain Bardet, who had been a disaster in the short stage, attacked a couple of times, finished third in the stage. So in a way, the only major disappointment, in my opinion, in today's stage was Chris Froome. He's the big loser of the day.
The cycling podcast is supported by Science in Sport.
Kiss goodbye to stomach problems with the world's first truly isotonic gel. Science in Sport Go Energy Isotonic. Before you hit the wall, hit back.
Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you to Science in Sport for sponsoring the cycling podcast. And you can get 25% off your Science in Sport stuff at scienceinsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. Now, one or two little bits of business before we return to the stage. As you might have heard in last night's podcast, we're doing an event at St David's Hall in Cardiff on Tuesday the 27th of November. That's at 7:30 p.m. Go to stdavidshallcardiff.co.uk, and that's stdavidshallcardiff.co.uk for tickets for that event. We're looking forward to our first ever event in Wales. Total coincidence that a Welshman could be about to win the Tour de France. Our book, as well, A Journey Through the Cycling Year, is now available to US listeners as an Audible book. It's just been launched in the US, so you can get that in your ears if you want. Our book, A Journey Through the Cycling Year, with contributions from, well, all of us here and lots of others besides. There's also, while the tour is still on, so a couple more days, 25% off the physical book in Watterson's and Foyles, well, online. If you go to their websites and enter the code Tour de France at the checkout, that's Tour de France at the checkout, you will get 25% off the cost of A Journey Through the Cycling Year. Back to the stage. Now, you mentioned, Francois, about the Lotto NL Jumbo's tactics being spot on. I mean, it was Hessink on his own that really brought that lead right back down to a minute. And really ruined Mikael Landa's day, because he was looking to be in a good position to go for the stage win and also move up overall. And what that told me as well was just how controlled the pace was when it was Sky, because as soon as Hessink swung off and actually Stephen Kruijswijk attacked, the gap went right back up again to the leaders. And, you know, presumably they're riding at the same speed. It was the Sky-led group that, when Sky were controlling the pace, were really controlling it. And I wondered whether that was it was sensible in the event, but also cautious, because, you know, they lost those guys probably a little bit earlier than they would have liked.
Well, and to me, as I said before, I think they did it on purpose to make sure the gap went up 3 minutes, and all of a sudden the Lotto Jumbo riders lost their GC positions. And as you said, at that moment when the gap went up to 3:20 or something, the Landa was second overall and Bardet was third. So it was not whereas Geraint Thomas' position was never in danger. So at that stage, because of the Team Sky tactics, because of the pace of the kind of slow pace they imposed, they really forced NL Jumbo to take the reins. I mean, they had no other choices, or they would have lost the stage and lost the GC positions. So it was a very wise move by Sky, in my opinion.
My one query on Lotto NL Jumbo was just the role of Kruijswijk, who attacked a couple of times. Was he setting up Roglic, or was he in fact riding his own race? Because he's in the top 10 as well. And, you know, it was Hessink alone, as I said, who chased down that group. Kruijswijk never did that. By jumping away, that may have been helping set up Roglic. You just don't know. But I didn't see much evidence that he was prepared to sacrifice his chances for Roglic. And perhaps he wasn't.
I don't think he was. No, I think they... Well, once they decided to take over the reins of the GC, of the you know, yellow jersey group, they had no Well, I think their idea was first to close the gap because the GC positions were in danger, but second to try and unsettle Team Sky by attacking in turns, and that's what they did. But once again, I'm pretty sure Steven Kreuzberg was like Landa, like Bardi, like all the guys who attacked, like Rafał Majka, who also attacked and found himself with Bardi and Landa up front at one stage. They were all going for the last chance of a stage win. So, yes, as you said, for me, there was it was not a planned move to allow Roglic to win in the end. It was just, you know, well, skirmishes or at least, you know, strokes, born at Team Sky to try and unsettle them. It didn't work, but it worked in a way, in a sense that Roglic finally won the stage.
I don't think they were going to loosen Sky's grip on the yellow jersey that by doing that, were they? I think by the time they got onto the, certainly over the Soulour, the little descent, and then the final climb of the Aubisque, by then, I think they knew we're racing here for the stage win and to bump Chris Froome off the podium, and they managed to do that. Then again, this is how races unfold. The priorities are changing all of the time, and I thought what Lotto and El Jumbo did today was actually, you know, they adapted, they changed their approach depending on the circumstances on the road. They used Hesink extremely well, and he was strong enough to do that job. Really in a kind of complete contrast to Movistar, who, yes, they got Valverde up the road first. Landa looked really good at times and then slightly frail at others. When he needed to be pressing on, he'd obviously gone too deep and didn't have enough to give. Well, all they succeeded in doing was blowing Nairo Quintana to the brink of the top 10, down from 5th to 9th. A really poor day for Quintana. And still, whereas you look at Lotto and El Jumbo's tactics and think, well, they got something out of today, Movistar, yet again, despite all of the talent, all of the strength they've got, really, well, they obviously they didn't, but they just never seem to get it right. I mean, it's astonishing, really, the number of times they've had a go at this tactic, and it never ever worked.
Well, it worked when Quintana won the stage the other day. I guess in their opinion, you know, I try to think the way they do. Quintana had won the stage. He crashed heavily yesterday, so it was probably the reason why he was dropped in the final climbs. But yes, I admit that their plan was a little bit clumsy, a little bit too obvious. Even though they also had Mark Soler at the front to help them out, they were just not at the same level as Team Sky, obviously, and not the same level at Lotto Jumbo.
But they must have been getting excited when Landa had gained 3 minutes and was at one point up to second, was he, on the virtual GC?
Yeah, he was up to second, yeah, absolutely. 1:15 behind.
But they had nothing more to give at that point, and obviously that then coincided with Lotto and El Jumbo.
Exactly.
That was obviously the danger mark for them to prompt them into action.
And an interesting little footnote to all of this, because Nicolas Portal gets a lot of credit for helping with the Team Sky strategy on the road. He's the sports director. The interesting thing about Portal is he used to ride, and he told you the other day, Francois, that he was confused by Movistar's tactics.
Yeah.
But he used to ride for the Movistar setup.
That's right,
he was a Case Depan rider before he joined Team Sky as a rider. He didn't ride very long for Team Sky. He had health problems. He had a heart problem, actually. And he retired quite young and moved into the driver's seat or the passenger seat in the team car. But he gets a lot of credit for being a very cool head under pressure and, you know, planning things well. And today what was interesting to me was the degree to which Geraint Thomas was writing to a plan. And the plan was, for him, follow Tom Dumoulin and don't worry about anybody else. When Roglic went off the front, Thomas didn't flinch, you know, and he knew, or they knew, that Dumoulin would be looking over his shoulder more than he was sort of looking to leapfrog Thomas. With the virtually 2 minute gap, he was more concerned, it seemed, by Roglic than by Thomas. And so, again, Thomas did that brilliantly. He'd obviously been told, ignore Roglic, ignore anybody, and just focus on Dumoulin. And we saw him do that a couple of days ago as well. Dumoulin was the guy they were obviously worried about.
Well, that's been the strategy from day one. Since Geraint Thomas got into the yellow jersey, his job really has been to mark Dumoulin and, well, leave everything else to look after itself, or see which stage they would need Chris Froome to get involved. As it turned out today, Chris Froome did get involved intermittently, sporadically,
briefly, yeah.
But he was off the back as much as he was able to help. And I think we saw... You know, we saw that he, well, we've seen the cracking point of Chris Froome today. He looked, well, he didn't look great, did he?
Well, he never looks great, to be fair. I mean, he's turning himself. There was an interesting contrast in styles of Geraint Thomas was smooth as silk, and Froome was all over the bike. I know he's had problems with saddle sores, and it looked to me like he was in pain as well as just suffering.
Yeah, what's the opposite of smooth as silk?
Rough as sandpaper.
Yeah, rugged.
Yeah, very good. But it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, Dumoulin today looked... he looked like he'd come off the top as well, and not as reactive. But just contrasting how Froome and Dumoulin have responded in this tour, having both ridden the Giro and having both finished on the podium in the Giro. I mean, they both backed up really pretty well, much better than perhaps we might have expected them to.
I mean, Dumoulin, we haven't really spoken a lot. There's been a lot made of Froome going for the Giro Tour double. Dumoulin, you know, could finish second in both, which is sort of probably disappointing a little bit for him. But that's a phenomenal achievement for, you know, when we consider that double hasn't been done since 1998. Dumoulin to you know, be so competitive in both these races, amazing.
Yeah, especially considering the record of Dutch riders in Grand Tours. I mean, when he won the Giro, you know, the Dutch had not won a Grand Tour for ages, almost since the days of, you know, Joop Zoetemelk. And now to be second in two Grand Tours, it's also something the Dutch riders, that there's been talent throughout the years, but never quite managed to do. And another thing, I wanted to say is you have to feel sorry for Chris Froome. I do, in a way, and that's I suppose that's the kind of inkling the the kind of fondness we the French have for the losers. But a very striking thing this morning is when I went to the podium to do a couple of interviews, Chris Froome went on the podium and he was cheered and then not booed for the first time in the tour, because he's not a threat anymore and because he showed his vulnerable side. So yeah, being partial to losers, I felt sorry for Chris Froome today.
A champion who loses with dignity always enhances his reputation, doesn't he? And I think he has lost with dignity. Who and when was the last Dutchman to finish on the podium of the Tour de France? Can anybody tell me?
Eric Breuking, maybe?
Oh, Francois, instantly in there, 1990.
Yeah.
So a long, long time since a Dutchman has finished on the podium of the of the Tour de France.
Yeah, and with Tom Dumoulin, you wonder, the big question is, does he regret having ridden the Giro? And, you know, he'd already won it. You know, he could only win it again. Obviously, that would have been an incredible achievement. But the way this tour has panned out, if he, we just don't know. If he'd been just a bit fresher, if he hadn't had the Giro in his legs, you would think he would have been the equal of Geraint Thomas over 3 weeks, and perhaps would have had just that little bit extra to go on the offensive more. We talked a couple of nights ago about the time lost on the stage to Mur de Bretagne, how pivotal that has turned out to be, but we haven't really seen Dumoulin make any gains. Thomas has always gained on Dumoulin on the key days. Dumoulin has not at any point gained on Thomas, and you wonder, had he not ridden the Giro, maybe he would have been in a position to make some gains. And well, that's a question that we can't truly know the answer to, but he may well have some thoughts in his own mind.
We talk a lot about some of the mishaps that riders had, you know, Bardet and Dumoulin on that stage, Landa on the cobbled stage, Chris Froome on day one. We don't talk much about the team time trial, and Lotto NL Jumbo, who've been such an impressive team, had an absolute shocker. You know, they lost 1:15 that day to BMC, and well, 1:11 to Sky. That's been extremely significant. I mean, it was a surprise at the time, but it's been very significant. And you know, Roglic, who is ending this tour in terrific shape, might have been going into this time trial with still a chance of winning it. Although, one little point about the time trial tomorrow, which is extremely hard. Geraint Thomas said after the stage say that he came to visit the area after the Dauphiné and recce all these stages. He rode the time trial course three times. Primoz Roglic has not ridden it yet. He will ride it in the morning. But an interesting sort of contrast there in the preparation of those two, and it adds further weight to this idea that Geraint Thomas, although he came in as a real dark horse and as a number two, you know, has been preparing for this Tour de France in a very methodical and thorough way.
Just on Lotto NL Jumbo's team time trial back in Cholet, stretching my memory a bit because it's almost 3 weeks ago, but I seem to remember one of the problems they had was that Roglic was going too hard and was causing the team to, if not break up, certainly causing some of the riders, the weak links, to be exposed, and they never really recovered from that. And so, you know, this again is about, you know, how you get Roglic as one of the strongest riders, one of the best time trialists in that squad, if not the best. You know, he was causing difficulties that have come back to cost him.
Well, I mentioned earlier one of the significant moments in the day was the sight of the four surviving Katusha Alpecin riders on the front of the bunch, and a lot of people wondered what on earth they were doing. It was fascinating for me to see that because I've been listening to the audio clips that Ian Boswell has been sending in every day. He's keeping an audio diary for us that will be released for friends of the podcast after the tour. It's been really fascinating to get an insight into a team that we haven't really been talking about or paying an awful lot of attention to. And a couple of days ago after the short mountain stage, Boswell's diary was really interesting because it was all about how Zakarin had gone that day. And while Ian had a bad day himself, Zakarin had a pretty good day and moved up overall to 12th and really felt that the top 10 was within his grasp, and that would be a result that he could be pleased with and proud of. So when I, you know, watched Katusha Alpecin do this on the lower slopes of the Tourmalet, I knew what the goal was. It was to try and propel Zakarin into a position where he might move up overall, and it worked. He's 10th and may well overtake Nairo Quintana, I would think, tomorrow to move up to 9th. But Ian sent us his latest little diary. He speaks to a couple of his teammates here after the stage. Here he is.
All right, in the back of the bus after stage 19, I got a message off Richard to ask me what our tactic was today, and I'm here with Niels Pullett, who's not a podcast fan, but he's looking for Instagram followers, so here I'm with him. And Niels was actually a big engine of today. We've been down to four riders for a while now, and to be fair, we haven't done a whole lot in this race. And today we missed the break, which we wanted to be in, but it maybe played out better. And Niels rode frickin' hard on the front for a long time, and Pavel, and I was lucky to just have to do a little 2K effort to sit and Zach up the road. And I think we have a lot of faith in our director, Dmitry Konachev, who never really puts pressure on us, but when he says to do something, I think we all trust him. Niels, did you think... I mean, Zach moved into the top 10, and that was our plan, and I think he can maybe even jump into 9th place tomorrow. Did you think... Did you think Konachev's tactic was wise at the time? I mean, you had to ride, and I was getting a lot of grief from a lot of riders in the peloton asking us what the heck we're doing.
Yeah, I think, we missed a break, so we have to change our tactic today. And, I think we did well. And, on the end, Konichev said directly to Tuck, he have to try on Tourmalet in the beginning, in the first part, and he did it. Before the Tourmalet, me and Pavel was pulling really hard. The problem was Bob Jungels was in the breakaway, so it's like, I think he was 2 minutes in behind GC, behind Zach in the GC, so we had to keep the group, the breakaway, close to the peloton.
Yeah.
And on the end, Zach is now 10, and tomorrow he can move to the 9th. Yeah.
Was today a success?
Yeah, I think yes.
Good job. Now we'll hear from Pavel. So now I'm with Pavel, who is probably the unsung hero of our Tour de France. He has been, well, Zach has been in the shadow of Pavel pretty much every day, every time Zach stops to pee. And Pavel pulled all of Col d'Espagne, before Col d'Espagne, into the bottom of Tourmalet. It wasn't our, I thought, I mean, it was a kind of a crazy tactic, but it moved Zach into the top 10, turned the race upside down. And you're happy with Konachev's choice? It paid off, didn't it?
Yeah, when I was riding in the front of the group, I was not so happy, but now, yeah.
It's all worth
it. I'm happy with the force, with the power of Zach, and so he was able to do it, and he's top 10 now. He's in top 10 now, and it's a good result. I hope tomorrow he will able to move again.
Yeah, and as I said, Pavel and Niels were riding from the when the break went, and a lot of people in the peloton, from Sky to Movistar, Lotto Jumbo, everyone was asking me what we're doing. But in the end, I guess now they know what our plan was. On to tomorrow, time trial.
Really interesting insights from Ian Boswell and from a team, as I say, that we've not been speaking about an awful lot. And it adds a new dimension to your watching and understanding of the race, to realise that all these teams have their own goals and targets. And, you know, when you look at the top 10 overall at the moment in this tour, we joke about, you know, riders riding a la Zubeldia almost invisibly into the top 10. There are no riders in that top 10 who've done that this year. They've all been prominent, they've won a stage, or they've been in attacks, and they've animated the racing. So it's been an interesting race from that point of view.
Yeah, that's what I said in the last couple of mountain stages, that everybody had been doing their job. You know, I mentioned all the teams almost in that stage except Katusha, but you're right. They set the fireworks, you know, in action in the first place. It might seem strange, you know, from the outside to see guys, you know, and teams entirely devoted to, you know, go for ninth place or eighth place, but it's tremendously important for them. Also in terms of UCI points, which are important when you want to stay in the World Tour and be a force in cycling. So yeah, we tend to overlook the importance for a team to have this morning I was talking to Vincent Avenue, the manager of Romain Bardet at AG2R, and he was saying, well, obviously, Bardet is going to try something today, and he's going to try something today maybe to win the stage if everything goes right. But he said being eighth or sixth overall is not the same thing. And so it was very important for them to lift Bardet a little bit in the GC, which he did.
Yeah, I think it depends on the identity of the riders, doesn't it? I just always think of Alberto Contador in the last couple of years of his career, when really he had nothing left to prove, nothing to lose. And so he could ride in a very aggressive way and, you know, really demonstrate his panache, because it didn't much matter if it went wrong and he ended up slipping from, say, 6th to 11th. That would not make any difference. So you've got different categories of rider, and Bardet is kind of moving into that category in this tour, where having finished second and third in the past, he has, you know, sixth or eighth or ninth, it really makes no difference. He may as well try something to go out in a blaze of glory, whereas Kruijswijk, Roglic, there's one or two others in the top 10, they will think, well, actually, I'll stick on this rather than twist and try and go for more, which is why I think Lotto NL Jumbo today actually deserve a lot of credit for trying to make gains and making gains.
Landa mentioned last night had said, you know, that he was probably going to be cautious and conservative today because Movistar, the team's classification to defend, and you know, two riders in the top 10. He may well have been bluffing, because again, his move today set the cat among the pigeons and ignited that stage in a way that made it so exciting to watch, and with so much going on. Geraint Thomas, though, I mean, we had an extended sort of feature last night, hearing from people who've worked with him over the years, none of them involved with Team Sky now, and we heard me at the beginning of the episode say that that I just could not see him winning the Tour de France. The reason was more to do with his tendency to crash, actually, and to also the one time he was in a position to finish on or close to the podium, 2015, he then fell ill, you know. And so I thought either he's gonna crash, or he's gonna have some bad luck, or he's gonna fall ill at some point. I just couldn't see how he could go through 3 weeks without one of these things happening.
It's not done yet, though. Tomorrow's time trial is hard. If it was just a flat or a rolling kind of, you know, traditional end of the tour time trial where the gains would be small between the likes of Thomas, Froome, Roglic and Dumoulin, I would say it's done. It's, you know, all he's got to do is pin on his number or stick on his number, and the tour is his. The climbs in the back half of that course are significant enough that pacing is going to be absolutely vital. You know, you could be looking at, you know, several seconds per kilometre on those climbs could be gained or lost if somebody gets their pacing wrong. I think there's danger lurks on that course, and I think that it will need a kind of a steady eddy performance. It doesn't need any heroics. It doesn't need any kind of dramatic, I must go and, you know, crush this, win it, and win the tour in the best style possible. He's done that already. He's won an Alpe d'Huez. He just needs a real kind of steady performance. And as an Olympic world team pursuit champion, a very good time trialist, I mean, he has got that mentality. He won't, I'm assuming, he won't be vulnerable to a kind of mad rush of blood to the head. But the danger still lurks there, I think.
I think, well, you know, talking about Thomas, I also had doubts in the beginning when I said, you know, that, you know, Team Sky had done the hardest part of the job in the Alps. I was still thinking halfway through the race that Chris Froome was still the leader and the number one chance to win the Tour again. I think I got Geraint Thomas wrong throughout the years, because, you know, I said in an event we had in Annecy the same thing. Oh no, it was in another event we had in La Gieta in the Alps as well. I said that you had to be a bad guy to win the Tour. I think I mistook Geraint Thomas for a good guy, because he's already smiling and he looks gentle and, you know, very self-composed and everything. And maybe I didn't see, and we didn't see, the bad guy hidden behind his black stare, you know, and his smile and the smile on his face. I think he proved in this story he was very determined. He knew exactly what he was doing. He never cracked, never let anything show. And maybe the determination he's had for all these years suddenly appeared evident in this tour. So well, so far, you know, credits for him. He really raced like a tour champion, and I really sincerely hope, despite my you know, I love Tom Dumoulin and the others, but he really deserves it to win this tour.
Your bad guy theory, Francois, I put that to Nigel Mitchell. We heard last night the nutritionist. He's at Education First now, but he was for many years at British Cycling Team Sky. He disagreed with that very strongly. He said you don't need to be a bad guy. He says this is a myth. He said you just need to commit to a plan, and that's what he's been good at. I mean, he came out with something else off the tape. He said that the Geraint's greatest asset is that he just does what they tell him to do. he's done three altitude camps, Tenerife, each of 2 weeks this year. You know, he has prepared for this Tour de France in a way that he hasn't before. He rode Paris-Roubaix. That was his one sort of concession, but he didn't, as he's done in the past, try to do both, you know, the classics and the stage races. And I think he did that 1 year before. It might have been 2015, was it, when he missed the classics and went for the Tour. He's done it once before, but you know, this is the first year he's done it and also had the luck, you know, or not had the bad luck that he's had before. And you know, there are some questions that people are understandably asking about a 32-year-old, you know, who's never been in the top 10 of a Grand Tour, never been on the podium, obviously, suddenly not just winning the Tour but doing so with such looking so comfortable. And the reason why I don't think the time trial is going to be, I've shown myself to be not great at predictions, but I can't see the time trial. I agree it's a very difficult time trial, but he looks supremely comfortable and confident at the moment in every way, Geraint Thomas. I don't see that he's going to suddenly emerge tomorrow as a different rider. But the question, it doesn't happen very often that a guy in his 30s who's never looked like winning the Tour de France before wins the Tour de France before. It happened with Bjarne Riis. And we know what was behind that story.
Maybe so, maybe Sastre as well, but it was the different circumstances, yeah.
Well, Riis was fifth and then third in a number of years before he won in 96. And, of course, was using EPO, some say, to excess. Well, any use of EPO is to excess, isn't it? But, you know, he was taking it to extremes. Yeah, I get that. I mean, I understand the kind of where's this result come from. But, you know, Geraint Thomas has had a sort of a snakes and ladders kind of career, hasn't he? I mean, he's been a world-class track rider. He's been, he's been good in time trials. He's been good in week-long stage races. You know, he's won Paris-Nice and the Dauphiné. Well, we haven't seen this kind of result or anything close to this kind of result, but he was close to... If he'd finished fourth in 2015, for example, say he hadn't blown up on that the penultimate mountain stage, or it was the final Friday, wasn't it? If he hadn't done that and he'd been fourth in the Tour in the past, would people view the result any differently? I mean, people were talking about Simon Yates as potentially winning a Grand Tour in the future because of the way he rode for all bar one mountain stage in the or two mountain stages in the Giro. So I think the evidence is there if you look at a career that spans back to 2007.
I mentioned as well, watching that old footage from 2011 Tour of Flanders, you know, the amount of times we've seen those white glasses that he wears, the white rimmed Oakleys, on or near the front of the bunch. You know, he has been a workhorse, and one quite revealing thing that Nigel Mitchell said last night was that the power files of riders at the ends of races, often Geraint was doing more work than anybody else, you know. So he's always been a workhorse. He is a guy who at 21 rode and finished the Tour de France, which is no small feat. So there's pedigree there, but I completely understand why people are sitting up and taking notice of a 32-year-old who hasn't looked like doing this before doing it.
As I said before, and I repeat myself here from yesterday, but I think he was a guy with tremendous potential in lots different, you know, lots of different directions. And my impression is that Team Sky didn't really know what to do with him. So in a way, they had him do everything, like classics, you know, 1 week stage races, Grand Tours. I mean, they tried him out about everything except winning the Grand Tour, and he probably wasted, you know, a little bit of time, or maybe lots of time, you know, not exactly knowing what to do, whether he was a guy who was going to only be winning Paris-Nice, or whether he was a guy who was going for Paris-Roubaix, and in the end, I think he even surprised probably the Dave Brailsford in showing that if, you know, you give him a precise objective like winning the Grand Tour, like sparing it, because he had he rode very few races compared to other seasons, did the Dauphiné, which is the golden path to winning the Tour, and maybe they should have, you know, given him his chance a little bit earlier, and he would have won the Tour before, or at least a Grand Tour before.
And there are all the results that we don't know he would have achieved had he not crashed at the Giro last year, and then finished second to Tom Dumoulin in the time trial with some pretty nasty injuries just a couple of days later, and then crashed also out of the Tour de France last year, having won the opening time trial. So yeah, there are all these results that he might have achieved had he not had this bad luck or the crashes that he suffered.
This sounds very much like reverse speculation. I'm not in favour of this at all.
Well, we'll not do that. Let's finish there, shall we, and carry on our journey to our wonderful hacienda. Thank you very much, Francois.
Merci beaucoup.
Oh, any French culture, any French flavour?
Actually, yeah, well, you know, La Reims, well, we talked a lot about cheese during this Tour de France. Well, but believe it or not, there is a very, very famous cheese fair in La Reims, because they do their own cheese called, believe it or not,
La Reims. So, so if
is that what we had on the buffet?
Yeah, I think that's what we had in the buffet. I think it's in August. So if you're in the area in August, you don't miss the La Reims cheese fair and have some more cheese.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Francois. Cheers, bye. Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
You have been listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2018 Tour de France. Thanks to our sponsors, Rafa and Science in Sport. The music is by Santoré. This episode was produced by John Mooney.